I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Lead is a colorless, odorless neurotoxin that can impair brain development and affect behavior, especially in young children. A few years ago, residents of Flint, Michigan began reporting that their tap water was orange and brown with a foul-smelling odor. Their hair was falling out, and welts would appear on their body when they showered. They complained to their local representatives and were told the water was safe. Our guest, pediatrician Mona Hannah Atisha, who treats families in Flint, was one of the first to recognize that there was an elevated level of lead in the city's water and therefore in children's blood. Elected officials fought her findings at first, but eventually acknowledged that Flint was in the throes of a serious public health crisis. Dr. Hannah Atisha has written a book about what happened in Flint and why, also about how her family immigrated from Iraq to the United States. It's titled What the Eyes Don't See, A Story of Crisis, Resistance, and Hope in an American City. And Mona Hannah Atisha, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Marty, it's great to be here, and it's great to be in Philadelphia.
Well, it's great to have you in Philadelphia, and I do want to talk about Flint today. How is the water supply in Flint today?
So the water quality has improved dramatically. Our lead levels are much lower and maybe even better than other cities right now. However, Flint is still under a public health emergency. The people of Flint are still required to use filtered water or bottled water because we are doing the infrastructure work of pipe replacement. Whenever you do earth-moving infrastructure work, you displace the lead scale, potentially, that's underneath. And because of that reason, people of Flint still need to take precautions.
I read that there's no more free bottled water, that people have to now pay for their bottled water. Is that correct?
Yeah. So the state ended the supply of free bottled water. We still have filters in place for the next few years, but the bottled water is now being supplied by faith-based organizations and nonprofits like the United Way.
You mentioned the fact. So is the goal then to replace all the pipes in Flint, Michigan?
Absolutely. And this is something that all cities need to be doing, including Philadelphia. So Flint will be the third city in the country that is replacing their lead pipes. Lansing, Michigan, Madison, Wisconsin are the two other cities that have replaced their lead pipes. It's a big problem, especially in the Northeast and the Midwest. And more cities need to invest in that infrastructure work to get the lead out of the ground.
This happened when Flint diverted its water. It actually began getting water from the Flint River. I had to look on a map. Shows you my ignorance about the middle part of the country. But this is a part of the country, the part of the world that is surrounded by the Great Lakes.
Absolutely, Marty. So Michigan, and specifically Flint, is in the middle of the largest source of fresh water in the world. The Great Lakes is 20% of the fresh water in the world, the largest source. And Flint is right smack dab in the middle of that largest source of fresh water.
And why did they do that? Why did they divert their water supply from wherever they were getting it before to the Flint River?
That's a great question.
Which had a history of being on fire and all of that.
The Flint River actually did catch on fire twice. So for half a century, Flint was getting fresh, pre-treated water from the Great Lakes, from Lake Huron. However, in 2011, Flint lost democracy, and we were under the control of state-appointed emergency management. And the goal of the emergency managers, and there was a series of them, was austerity. It was to save money. And it was decided that the water that we had been getting from the Great Lakes, you know, high-quality water, was too expensive for this poor, near-bankrupt, predominantly minority city, and that to save money, we would start drawing water from the local Flint River until a new pipeline was built to the Great Lakes. So the move to the Flint River was supposed to be temporary.
But this was 2011?
This was in 2014. 2011, we became under the control of emergency management. April of 2014, with a very simple flip of a switch, we switched over to Flint River water.
With the advantage of hindsight, if they had done something, maybe treated that water or done something to the pipes, could they have prevented this problem when they flipped over to Flint River?
Yeah, you're right, Marty. So if, you know, the fault of this crisis was not the Flint River. Many people blame the Flint River because they think about the history of industrial pollution. But if the water was treated properly, it would have been probably okay. It would have been hard to manage, but probably okay. So the treatment of that water was missing an important ingredient. It was missing the corrosion control, the corrosion inhibitor, which is a part of water treatment to prevent that whatever's in the plumbing from coming out and going into the drinking water.
the big question is why. I mean, why was that not done?
That's a great question, and that's why we have many, many investigations, many criminal charges, many lawsuits, to really fundamentally get at that why.
Well, you mentioned this. What this is a poor city. It's a majority-minority city. I mean, do you think there was some, I don't know how to frame it exactly, something about, if not race, about socioeconomics? Or because here we are, you know, the richest country in the world, and you've got a city, a good-sized city of 100,000 people who can't trust their own water.
Yeah, Marty, it's so ironic. The richest country in the history of the world, in the middle of the Great Lakes, in the 21st century, with rules and regulations that govern safe drinking water, yet there's a population of people who are predominantly poor and predominantly minority who don't have access to that. Mm-hmm. So many investigations and reports have looked at kind of the why, and most point to that this was another form of environmental injustice, mm-hmm. that the demographics of the population, their poverty, their race, exacerbated the crisis and had it last for so much longer. Jesse Jackson called this a crime scene. Michael Moore said it was a racial crisis that never would have happened in a richer or a whiter community.
I quoted some of the residents there who were complaining about what the water looked like, what it smelled like, and how it was affecting their bodies. There were a number of women, including a woman named Leanne Waters and her family. I mean, she seemed to be...
She's amazing.
Of
an
the
amazing
numbers
mom.
Of whistleblowers, she clearly was one.
She started this whole thing. So Flint is a story of an amazing activists, especially moms who are not only fighting for their children, but fighting for all children. So she was actually the person, this stay-at-home mom, who discovered that Flint was not treating its water properly. She's the one that found out they were not using corrosion control.
And she saw changes in her children, or at least its effect on her children.
Yeah, so she noticed a lot of skin manifestations, which were the first findings of this water crisis. There was a lot of things in this water that were irritating people's skin. We had bacteria in the water. Then we had a lot of chlorine added to kill the bacteria that irritated people's skin and eyes. But a lot of people were presenting with rashes and hair loss and rashes up to the waterline, you know, when they were bathing their children. And her kids were getting sick. They were losing their hair. One of her children actually stopped growing.
You write here, baby after baby had come into our clinic. We gave them the same advice. It's fine. It's just fine. Drink the water. Of course, it's okay. I mean, you're described as one of the whistleblowers, but you also describe yourself as one of the last of the dominoes in uncovering this crisis. So even as a pediatrician, I'm assuming you drank the water of Flint. Even you didn't recognize what was going on.
Yeah, that really gets to the title of the book, What the Eyes Don't See. So lead, as you said, is colorless, odorless, tasteless. The effects of lead are also invisible. It's known as a silent pediatric epidemic. We don't see it presenting in our clinics. So I very much was reassuring my patients that were coming in. Moms, should I be mixing my baby's formula with this water? Yes, it's okay. How can our water not be okay? How can the water that we turn on from our tap in America not be okay?
You even describe, I think, being in a barbecue in your backyard, and you had a friend who told you where the water was coming from in Flint, and the wheels began to turn.
Absolutely. So my real involvement began the night in my home with a high school girlfriend who happened to be a water expert. She worked at the EPA and worked at the EPA in Washington, D.C. when Washington, D.C. had a very similar lead and water crisis about a decade ago. And she cornered me in my room. Our children were playing, and she, you know, she's like, Mona, you know, Flint's water is not okay. I'm like, how can it not be okay? Of course it's okay. And she's like, well, they're not treating it properly with corrosion control. And I'm like, what are you talking about? What is corrosion control? And she's like, without corrosion control, there's going to be lead in the water. And I had never heard about the possibility of lead being in water. And very, you know, naively, I didn't even know until that point that our plumbing was actually made of lead. Mm-hmm. This is all about what my eyes didn't see. For years, I have been treating children with lead poisoning, both in Detroit and Flint, and never before did I ever think that water could be a contribution to their lead exposure.
Would you draw blood and you'd see elevated levels of lead and say, gosh, I wonder where this is coming from?
Yeah, we'd always have to find out. We'd have to have kind of a differential, which is a long list of where could this be coming from. And it was always paint, 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 soil, 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 dust, dust, dust. Because that's how I've been trained, and that's how everybody in medicine and and public health has been trained. We screen children for lead at the ages of 1 and 2 because that's when children developmentally are walking and crawling and they have hand-to-mouth activity when they're at risk for household lead exposure. Lead in water impacts an entirely younger age group, and we don't screen that age group, especially the unborn and babies who are using this for their formula. So we don't know. We don't know the extent of lead exposure in this younger population, especially since the window of detection of lead in blood is very short.
But you also say that lead is one of the most examined,
neurotoxins.
So it's not like if we haven't looked at this.
You're right. And, you know, the word lead comes from the Latin plumbum. So the elemental symbol for lead is PB. It comes from the Latin plumbum, the Roman, which means plumbing. So lead actually means plumbing. The Romans built their aqueducts out of lead plumbing. And many people, this theory is that hypothesize the demise of the Romans is because they used so much lead, not only in their plumbing, but they actually also put it in their food and did other crazy things with it. But we've known about lead's toxicity for centuries, yet we've lacked the political will to do anything about it. You know, we didn't restrict lead from our service lines till 1986, but it was not restricted from our brass fixtures and our faucets until 2014. So it is an example where the science has been clear, yet the policies have not caught up with the science.
Let me reintroduce you. That's Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha, and she is a pediatrician. She works in Flint, Michigan, and she's written a new book called What the Eyes Don't See, A Story of Crisis, Resistance, and Hope in an American City, and it's about the discovery of the crisis in Flint, the crisis of lead in the water that then showed up in lead in the blood, certainly of young children. You can join us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So once you began to see, well, perhaps there's some kind of connection between this water supply and the levels of lead, how did you go about sort of figuring out its impact and where it might be in the city and which children were really greatly affected by this?
Sure. So you mentioned the amazing moms who were raising their voices and the activists and pastors and journalists. For 18 months, people were raising their voices that there was something wrong with this water. Mark Edwards, who's a renowned water engineer, when he was contacted by this mom, Leanne Walters, he came up to Flint literally overnight and packed his minivan with graduate students with supplies and worked hand in hand with the people of Flint to uncover the lead in the water. And he very much transparently was sharing, hey, there's lead in the water everywhere. This is a problem. And he was also being dismissed and attacked. Actually, the state called him something of a magician, that he was pulling rabbits out of hats, that wherever he would go, he would find lead in water. So I followed all their work. I learned about the lead in water. And I knew I needed to see if that lead in water was getting into the bodies of our children. So I conducted the research on children's blood lead levels, looking back at children's lead levels and comparing them from before the water switch and after the water switched. And what we found was, contrary to anything that was happening in our state, nation, even our city, where lead levels had been coming down in children, we saw that they increased after the water switch, the percentage of children with elevated lead levels. We saw that it directly correlated with areas that had the highest water lead levels. Parts of the city that had the highest water lead levels had the greatest increase in children's blood lead levels. And we also noticed that there was nothing happening outside of the city's water supply. And we also very much realized from that very beginning that this was an underestimation of the impact. Children weren't screened when they didn't know there was a lead in water crisis. They weren't being screened at the right ages, and that half-life of lead is so short. So it was a massive underestimation, but we publicly shared that research that we were concerned about children's lead levels.
What was the highest level? And you write about a foster home, I think, rather near the hospital, and the levels that you found there.
Yeah, so the water lead levels that were found throughout the city were in the hundreds and thousands of parts per billion. This was the water lead levels. We had a home with a water lead level of 22,000 parts per billion. Our schools...
What is acceptable?
So the EPA has a maximum contaminant goal of lead in water, which is 0 parts per billion. But for a water system, the action level is 15 parts per billion, which is not health-based. It's just based on feasibility. So, like, you know, there were samples, hundreds and thousands. And like you mentioned, the lowest day in this whole crisis was when we had a foster home for troubled children, which was close to the hospital, that had a lead level of 5,000 parts per billion.
That was in the water.
In the water. And these are kids who already had every adversity. And it should have ended when we knew about lead in the water. It never should have gotten to the point where we needed evidence that there was lead in children's blood, because that is too late.
Well, taking that 22,000 parts per, when you looked at the lead in the children, what did you find?
So what we found was an increase in the percentage of children who had levels that were greater than 5 micrograms per deciliter or more. It had doubled in the city. And then in the areas where the water lead levels were the highest, it had also increased. But once again, a massive underestimation. In lead detection, we so often use children as detectors for environmental contamination. And that is wrong. We need to be focused on something called primary prevention, where children should never be exposed to lead. Mm. We should detect it in the environment first. And we knew that. We knew it was in our water.
Help us understand then the effect. And it should be said that decades ago, I mean, lead was everywhere in gasoline.
Absolutely.
And I think, you know, if you grew up in America, chances are you were exposed to lead. But talk about the effect on cognition, behavior, learning, IQ.
Right, Marty. So decades ago, we had contaminated this earth with lead because of lead in gasoline, lead in paint, and lead in other sources. And levels that we thought were okay then, we now know through incredible science, are no longer okay. We now know, per the Centers for Disease Control, the American Academy of Pediatrics, that there is no safe level of lead. And we also have learned that the very lowest levels can even more dramatically impact children's cognition and behavior. Lead is a potent, irreversible neurotoxin. It impacts thinking, so it actually drops IQ levels. It impacts behavior, causes developmental disabilities, attention disorders. It's even been linked to criminality. Mm-hmm. So incredible science. The more we study lead, the more we learn about its evil. And we now very clearly know that there is no safe level, that the impact is subclinical. We don't see it with our eyes, and it impacts populations. And we also very much know that it is already a form of environmental injustice, because it's Flint kids, Detroit kids, Philadelphia kids, Chicago kids, some of our country's most vulnerable children, who are already rattled with so many obstacles to development, are already impacted by higher levels of lead exposure.
We're almost up on a break here, but you would think, since lead levels were so high a generation or two ago, that we would have those same kind of symptoms. But is there something different today, do you think?
So we can never know, you know? So Phil Landrigan was a pediatrician physician, a lead fighter, who really was credited with getting lead out of paint. They say that his work getting lead out of paint actually raised the IQ of the nation. So pre-industry, we had no lead in our bodies. It was because of our efforts that, you know, because of industrial applications, that we put lead into this earth and then into the bodies of our children. We've learned a lot since then. And, you know, even though it was higher before, does not mean it's okay now. And it definitely does not mean that the injustice and crisis in Flint is permissible.
That's Mona Hanna Atisha. She's a pediatrician, she's a scientist, she's now an activist, and she's also an author, What the Eyes Don't See, a story of crisis, resistance, and hope in an American city, about her work and the work of others in Flint, Michigan, to identify the source of the dangerous levels of lead in the water that showed up in the blood of Flint's young residents. You can join us, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with pediatrician Mona Hanna Atisha. She was a early on whistleblower in the Flint, Michigan water crisis. She collected data detailing dangerous levels of lead in the blood of Flint's young residents. City officials fought her findings, denying that the water was contaminated. 4 years since, lead levels in the city's drinking water have declined, but health issues and concerns persist. And she writes about all of this in her book, What the Eyes Don't See. Let me quote from something that was actually in the New York Times just a couple of days ago, July 22nd. The children of Flint were not, quote unquote, poisoned. It's by Drs. Hernan Gomez and Kim Dietrich. They begin by saying, were, let me quote here instead of trying to paraphrase, let's be clear. It's unacceptable that any child was exposed to drinking water with elevated, that it is unacceptable that any child is exposed to drinking water with elevated lead concentrations. But goes on to say, not a single child in Flint tested high, CDC high of 45. This was a surprise for several visiting celebrities who requested a visit to the lead ward of Hurley Children's Hospital. And it goes on to say, basically, to push back against what you and others are saying, which is that the lead levels were high in Flint, Michigan, with possible impacts on children's health.
Yeah, so this article is timely and is very consistent with the history of lead in regards to those who have denied the toxicity of lead and have been skeptical of its impact. Physicians are often very myopic. We only see what's in front of us, and we fail to see the subclinical impacts, the population-level impacts that can happen. We now know that, you know, just because a child is not hospitalized, does not need medical treatment like chelation, is not seizing in a coma from acute lead intoxication, does not mean that there's no problem. So this fundamentally gets at why I wrote this book, what the eyes don't see. Just because we don't see an acute medical problem does not mean that there are no ramifications. So this is disrespectful of really the science of public health, of primary prevention, and very much of the painstaking science that has now informed that there is no safe level of lead, and especially of the dangers of low-level toxicity.
If there is no safe level, but we do accept a certain level.
We don't accept any
level.
There is no safe level.
Okay. I mean, even the CDC and others.
It says no safe level of lead.
There's no. So the goal is to get lead out.
So, yeah, one of the great effects of Flint has been the national repercussions in terms of lead elimination. We need to get to the point where no child is exposed to lead. We need to get to that point of primary prevention where we are screening environments rather than children, recognizing that when children are exposed, it is an irreversible neurotoxin. So we can do it. We have the ability to do it. The science is there on how to eliminate children's exposure, but we have lacked that political will and investment.
I mean, the goal then is to get it out of the water, get it out of the paint, get it out of the dirt, get it out of the dust. But it is pervasive.
It is
when
pervasive.
You add all that together.
Lead is a heavy metal. It persists, especially from old homes and old neighborhoods, soil from the contaminated gas. But a recent study that came out a couple years ago by Pew showed that if we eliminated children's exposure to lead, we would save our nation $80 billion a year. When you think of decreased economic productivity, healthcare costs, special education costs, criminal justice costs, we actually also know the economic benefit of eliminating nationally children's lead exposure.
We're talking about children. They don't vote.
They need to vote.
6 years old, 6 year olds don't vote. I mean, is that part of the problem? Yes, they have parents who lobby for them, but they're not a constituency in the traditional sense.
I just wrote an article about the need for our children to vote.
Oh, really?
So, yes, you know, I think I reflect on what's happening right now in our nation, and it's almost as if we've lost the voice of children. We're almost at war with our children. Look at child separation. Look at childhood poverty in this nation. Look at how we are using CHIP, children's health insurance, as a bargaining tool. Look at the water in Flint. Look at our cuts to EPA regulations. Children will be impacted the first. How do we elevate the voices of children? In some places, they've considered something called demini voting, where parents each get a half vote for each child. Maybe if we did allow children to vote or lowered the voting age, we would treat them as a constituency and we would put in policies to fully protect them.
Well, that's interesting. Then let me see what our listeners have to say. 1-888-477-9499. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. We have, looks like Deborah from Lansdowne, PA joining us. Deborah, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks
there.
For taking my call.
Sure.
I thought I'd just share that I am a high school chemistry teacher here in the Philadelphia area. And in my course, the kids are in 10th grade, and in my course we've inserted an entire unit about Flint because what happened in Flint is really a chemistry problem. And so we explained to them the chemistry of what happened, all about, as your guest was talking about, the prevention of the corrosion of the lead pipes. We really go deeply into that. But it opens up a huge and really meaningful discussion for the students, not only about science, but about where their water comes from, which they've never thought about before, and the needs for water control. And it opens up really significant conversations about our country and our culture and our politics. So really, this is kind of a message for all the teachers out there that it's a really excellent teaching opportunity.
Well, that's a great call. I mean, there is nothing more basic than water. Go ahead, Mona.
You are awesome. Kudos to you for teaching our next generation of kids. My real hat is a medical educator. What we do and what we inspire and what we instill in the next generation, they need to go out and fix our problems. You know, when I wrote this book, it was students in mind. And it was, you know, college students and high school students and even junior high students. You know, they need to learn these lessons. It's not just about chemistry. It's about democracy. It's about poverty. It's about race, but it's fundamentally who are we and who do we want to be? How do we take care of our neighbors? So thank you for talking about this issue.
Yeah, Deborah, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me read some comments. One from Andrea. What can one include in his or her diet to leach lead from his or her body? Are there ways to do that?
Yeah, nutrition plays an incredible role, primarily in the prevention of lead exposure. You know, kids in inner cities, you know, vulnerable children all over, like I said, in Detroit and Philly and Chicago, are harder hit by lead exposure because of like poor housing stock, because of the environment, and also because of poor nutrition. When a child has an empty stomach, or if a child is deficient in certain nutrients, especially calcium and iron and vitamin C, they absorb lead more readily. And in the long term, lead only lasts a short period in your blood, but eventually gets stored in your bones and can come out really for decades in periods of stress or pregnancy or poor nutrition. So nutrition is a forever solution, and as part of our recovery work in Flint is making sure that children have access to great nutrition.
A question from Brian. Would Dr. Hannah Atisha consider running for public office? Like every other woman in this country, right?
Right now, I am committed to the children of Flint. You know, we very much are in the midst of this crisis, but Flint is doing incredible state-of-the-art innovative work in terms of our recovery, really leaning on the science of child development to mitigate the impact of this crisis. It is my goal that Flint is not remembered for this crisis, but really remembered for the work that we are doing to resolve this crisis.
A question is, Dr. Hannah Atisha presenting her data at a pediatric conference or pediatric conferences. And I should add that part of this book is that you were doing research, but, you know, you have to have things peer reviewed and it takes time. And on the other hand, as a physician working in Flint, you had a crisis on your hands.
Yeah. So initially, our research was not peer reviewed. It was not presented in a publication because that takes time. And our kids did not have a day to spare. So I literally walked out of my clinic and shared this research. But it was a form of academic disobedience. Since then, it has been peer reviewed. It has been published. And it's other articles since then have also been published that talked about the impact of this crisis. I've also presented at many other pediatric presentations. I was just at CHOP this morning.
Oh, interesting. There was an outbreak of Legionnaires. That has not gotten the same kind of coverage that the lead crisis in Flint has, and connected to the water.
It definitely should. So we talked a lot about lead, but this crisis is far beyond lead. The skin issues. One of the largest outbreaks of Legionnaires disease was during this crisis, and 12 people died, and there was an uptick of overall pneumonia mortality, also because of the untreated water. Because of that, some of the criminal charges against state and city officials are actually negligent homicide charges.
Wow.
Because of those Legionnaires' deaths. But more than that, this water crisis was a trauma of betrayal, of trust, and this anger and stress and guilt. And that in and of itself, those feelings in and of itself can lead to poor outcomes. So we are treating this entire trauma as an added kind of toxic stress, as a trauma. You can think of it like PTSD. And when we framed it that way, it's really given us a playbook of interventions on how to respond with things like trauma-informed care and other resilience-building supportive interventions.
Was there a moment when the skepticism about what you and others were finding changed or turned, where all of a sudden officials are saying, well, maybe we are dealing with a real crisis here?
Yeah. So, you know, even when my research was released, my science was attacked, my credibility was attacked. But finally, there was a breakthrough. The state medical doctor called me. We had a physician-to-physician conversation. They relooked at their data. And within a few weeks, they conceded and said, yes, actually, our data is consistent with this data. We do have a problem.
And after that, did things change?
Yeah. So within, you know, less than a month of this the public release of this data, we went back to treated Great Lakes water. And that was in October of 2015. We went back to treated Great Lakes water. But the 18 months that we were on this corrosive, untreated water ate up our pipes. It ate up the infrastructure. So that is why they need to be replaced.
Well, interestingly, and there was a company that I guess it was GM also in Flint getting their water from the Flint River. They noticed it was affecting their pipes. They switched back, right?
So General Motors was born in Flint. It's the birthplace of cars. General Motors still has plants in Flint. And within months of getting on of switching to Flint water, General Motors noticed that this water was corroding their engine parts. And they got a bypass to go back to Great Lakes water. And that's the crisis should have ended there. Like if the drinking water is corroding engine parts, what is it doing to our aging infrastructure that has lead?
You mentioned Leanne Walters, one of the moms or people living in Flint who were sounding the alarm. There was an article a couple months ago in The Guardian where she's quoted as saying, "The biggest thing that people are not talking about is the psychological damage. I've seen people go into full-on panic attacks, hyperventilating, trying to take a sip of water at a restaurant, and they just can't do it. I know of a 17-year-old who is terrified to take a bath. These things have not gotten better." She's talking about just the psychological aftermath.
This is the trauma. This is the behavioral health issues. And this is what we see every day. It's the moms who are worried about their children. We have four-year-olds who have never touched this water because, you know, the water switch has been happening for that long, and they actually fear the water. That's not how it needs to be. That's not how it can be in the United States. So we are very much addressing that mental health trauma. We have trauma crisis lines. We have behavioral health services and different programs in place to address the trauma of the crisis, which, like I said, is way more than lead. It is, you know, the people of Flint were betrayed by every single government agency that was supposed to protect them, and they were betrayed.
Well, which raises a number of questions, which you address in the book. One is that if you've got government officials who have betrayed you, but you need a government and government officials to fix the problem, where does that leave a skeptical public? Believing, yeah. I mean, you're saying things are better. There's progress in Flint, but I'm sure there are people living in Flint who are saying, yeah, prove it.
Of course. And it's going to take a long road to recovery. This crisis happened because, the real villains are the villains of austerity, the villains of an emasculated government. These drinking water departments, and they've been cut, they've been underfunded, there was poor morale, there wasn't an emphasis on public health. It was that ideology that created this crisis. We need good government. We need government that is responsive and accountable and science-based. That is how we will get towards a greater recovery.
Do you drink the water in Flint?
I have now learned in these last few years that our water everywhere was never intended to be lead-free. There's lead in all of our plumbing because we stubbornly did not listen to science. So I use filtered water or bottled water in Flint and outside of Flint. And for vulnerable populations like pregnant moms and small children, they should also take precautions. And there are simple things that can be done, like running your cold water, never using hot water for cooking or drinking, which I didn't even know, but hot water increases the leaching of lead from your plumbing. But always running that cold water, flushing that water in the morning, especially after periods of non-use, until we get lead out of our plumbing, until we strengthen the regulations, which are grossly weak and not science-based or health-based, we will continue to find lead. And week after week, we hear about a school or a city that is testing and finding lead in their water because there is lead in the water.
Is this why you became a pediatrician?
I am just doing my job. Part of being a pediatrician is being an advocate. It is always our duty and our obligation to protect children. I literally took an oath to protect children, and I just continue to do my job to protect kids.
And our kids, thinking of the future of kids in Flint, are they going to be okay?
Absolutely. And that is the message of this book. It's a message of the story. It's a message of the crisis, but it's a story of activism and resistance, which we all need to, hear about right now. But more importantly, it is a story of hope and recovery. We are committed. It's a city that has rolled up their sleeves and committed to making sure that the children of Flint are going to be better than okay. And we are also committed to sharing our best practices because there are kids everywhere suffering from very similar toxicities, the toxicity of poverty and racism and lost democracy and violence and incarcerated parents. These are all toxicities. And emerging science has taught us that these toxicities leave lifelong scars. So we are actually in Flint hoping to share what we learn to other communities to protect more children.
Well, it's been a great pleasure to have you with us on Radio Times. A great honor as well.
Likewise. Thank
you. Mona Hanna Atisha, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times. And again, she's a pediatrician, works in Flint, Michigan at Hurley Children's Hospital, also affiliated with Michigan State University, a scientist, now an activist, and she's also an author, What the Eyes Don't See, A Story of Crisis, Resistance, and Hope in an American City. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and we have posted or will be posting some photos from today's program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.